First of all, I think something should be said about the bleakness of the poem. The title, of course, is The Wasteland, and it's bleak, and so it was well named. But when I was talking about this poem before with the lifestyle students, I brought up something that two quotations that Ernest Becker uses in the beginning of his book, Escape from Evil, and the one is from Thomas Hardy. If a way to the better there be, it lies in taking a full look at the worst. If a way to the better there be, it lies in taking a full look at the worst. And that maybe can help us in thinking about why one can benefit from reading a poem that is an experience in the wasteland. The other quotation, we can say this is obviously, many people at the time this poem came out in 1922 said this is obviously a poem written by somebody with an unhealthy mind. So I read the second quote from Ernest Becker. The second quotation that Becker uses in his, to preface his Escape from Evil, and that's from William James. And the quotation is, "There is no doubt that healthy-mindedness is inadequate as a philosophical doctrine, because the evil facts which it positively refuses to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may, after all, be the best key to life's significance, and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest levels of truth." It's a pretty big words. Read it one more time. "There is no doubt that healthy-mindedness is inadequate as a philosophical doctrine, because the evil facts which it positively refuses to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may, after all, be the best key to life's significance, and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest levels of truth." When I talked before with the lifestyle students, we developed a little further that in looking at the evil and looking at the ugly, one starts to, as one looks more at that, one starts to see in the ugly, in the evil, a noticeable lack. And that lack is shaped very much like Christ. That lack is shaped very much like Christ. In this poem, there's a noticeable lack that Eliot keeps talking about. The hangman is not there. The cross has happened, Christ is buried, and we're dying with a little patience. But there has been no resurrection. That this is one of the problems that some of the speakers in this poem are having, is that they've seen the ugly. They have not seen the shape of Christ, the substance of Christ in their lives, and they are waiting with a little patience, dying with a little patience. There's more to say about the use of Christ imagery in the end of this poem, and we'll get to it then. One thing the poem does is that it shows our society, or the society, urban society of 1922, it shows society to itself against a backdrop of past glory, past meaning, past liveliness. And it starts out with the first line with a reference to the first line of the first major work of English literature. And that's Canterbury Tales, Prologue to Canterbury Tales. And I thought I'd read you just a few lines to help show how this poem works as an ironic, it shows an ironic confrontation between a past that was gracious and a present that is graceless. And that's one of the major things that happens in this poem. And Eliot continues to put lines, quote, lines from literature, world literature, not just English literature, in German, in Italian, in in other languages, to show it. We used something like this used to happen, and in the old days one responded to it this way, and now we respond to it this way, and our response to even spring is so different nowadays. And the first line of this poem, April is the cruelest month. April is the cruelest month. The first line of Canterbury Tales, what is the people's response to April? When April showers with sweetness pierce the root of droughts of March and make the buds upshoot and bathe the veins in sap wherefrom the flowers are born to blossom in these vernal showers, when soft west winds have breathed upon the trees and tender sprouts appear on all the leaves, and when the youthful sun has run his course half through the ramp, the sign of springtime's force, when little birds, so stirred by nature's might, they seem with open eyes to sleep all night, make melody a song. Then folk also on pleasant pilgrimages long to go, and palmers want to seek some far-off strands and distant shrines well known in many lands, especially from every county's end of England down to Canterbury they wend, the holy blessed martyr there to seek, that help will give if they are sick or weak, and that there is a continual hope. And in this poem, there is a kind of pilgrimage going on, and it's a pilgrimage that's going on without hope. We'll meet that line, without hope, again, in the name Stetson. Stet means no hope. And he says, he addresses the character, son of no hope. You, my reader, hypocrite, my brother. He draws the readers into this world. He says, not only is this the world of the speakers of this poem, it's your world too. Now, that's hard to take. I would hope that we don't say that that was so in 1922, but of course now in the last 50 years it is no longer the case. In a strange way, two of the themes in this poem talks about life as a living death, and it talks about death as possibly bringing resurrection. Now that's a theme that we recognize, and it seems that at least in a sense, accepting this wasteland, this death as our own, makes possible a resurrection. Out of these ashes, a new life can start to come. This is hopefully not a poem that drags you down like a whirlpool, which is also in the poem, but something that we can make the connection with parts of our life, and then come back with more life from that. I think in some ways that refusing this connection locks us in a funny sort of way, locks us into this poem, locks us into more wasteland than is necessary in our life. Now, I've said that before that this poem shows us a picture of a world without Christ. It shows us a world, the picture of a world without Christ, and it's unnerving. It's unnerving, at least to me, to recognize so much in that world. Does that make sense to those who've read it? There's an unnerving quality about this poem. There's no Christ there. It's about the wasteland. It's a nightmare. It's about the emptiness. That's about many things. It refers to many things. It's about the negatives, the emptiness, the death, the fear, and so forth. The world without Christ, that doesn't live in the promises of Christ, as Bev mentioned tonight in that fantastic Vespers message. And yet I recognize this world. This was something that bothered Charles Williams, one of the Inklings. It bothered him about this poem when it first came out. He says, I don't like it. I can't talk about it. as a modern poem. There are all these other poets talking about the sweet sounds, and then there's this Eliot, who's written at that time, the time he wrote this essay, had written Proof Rock and Wasteland and Hollow Men and Gerontion, and he says, in his introduction to his book of criticism on modern poetry in 1937, I think it was, he did not include Eliot as one of the major British modern poets. And yet, I read some of those essays, and I read his introduction, and in his introduction, he writes one of the best essays of praise to Eliot that I've ever seen, while he's apologizing for not putting him in the book of poetry, because this man was so different. And he said, the man, he's so different from these other people, I'd have to change the whole conception of the book to deal with him. I said, the man gives us images of hell, and I don't know how to deal with that. But he does give us images of hell, and he says, I am frightened as I walk down the streets of London, and lines from the wasteland leap to mind as I see things happening on the street. I wish I had, now just thinking right now, I wish I had Blake's poem on London. I wish I had that by memory. Do you have that by memory by any chance? Do you? Darn it, I should have that. Do you have it? It's a super thing, and great. Okay, marks of weakness, marks of woe. Day I walk these chartered streets near where the chartered Thames does flow, and then on every face, you know, I meet our marks of weakness, marks of woe. You know, and he goes on. It's just this is not how new really is. Did you find it?
I don't know which one you're
talking
about.
You got her?
Good. And they tuck it in Jerusalem somewhere, don't they? Yeah, here it is, London. I think it was unnerving to Williams to find that Eliot was doing some of these things. He didn't make a Blake connection, but I think if you know Blake's poetry, you see some connections with the world that Eliot is writing about. And the poem of Blake is, I wander through each chartered street near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every band, the mind-forged manacles I hear. The mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. And the hapless, the luckless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear, and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. And blights with plagues the marriage hearse. Now it's interesting that you make, it is a brand new connection for me, I haven't made it before, but Spencer's line in the poem about run softly, sweet Thames, run softly while I sing my song, is from one of Spencer's poems in celebration of Christian marriage. And I think that marriage or lack of marriage is one of the themes here. The two people who are married are in the section of the poem called The Chess Game. The chess game is a war in which no one touches. And that's exactly what happens in that section of the poem. It's a frightening poem to talk about. It's to talk about in an hour and a half especially because it is so rich. I left a big notebook at home because it's getting too heavy. So I wanted to just go from this poem, just from the text tonight. Read through it, talk about a few things, and then afterwards, I think it'll take about half the time, and then have questions on it. And feel free to ask questions during the thing too. I don't feel that since, well, maybe I should mention this now. You know, films by Antonioni, Bergman, some of the European filmmakers that show, where the films show a scene here and then they jump, you know, 200 miles and a scene here and a scene and a flashback and forward and close-ups and backing off and so forth. That the method of putting together some of those avant-garde films is the method that Eliot is using in 1922 in this poem. It's a whole new thing for English poetry. Well, not just English poetry. It's a whole new ballgame. And it just made people furious when it came out. Some of the young bucks went for it, got excited about it, but it took a while to be accepted. This is what he's doing in this poem. As you're confused from line to line, many times it's a new voice speaking in the poem, comes in. You'll be watching a scene and then all of a sudden you hear a voice from over here and then the camera just changes scene and catches up with a voice over here and you're in another, whole other scene. They'll show you a picture, one of the scenes will be, say, in this room. And then all of a sudden, you know, as you're reading the poem, it's like you're walking through a room, watching this stuff happen and hearing these voices. And then you open the door and you're in another room. Okay, a whole new room with a whole new set of people and maybe a new class of people, a whole new language and a whole new thing happening. And it's all new and it's all old. It's all the same old story again and again and again. Now that's a way to look at it. And I'm only hoping tonight to start this poem. The lifestyle students know that I've never done anything more than that and hope never to do anything more than that too. One other note about the notes. When this poem came out, they said the guy's got to be crazy. But there was this about 20 very careful notes with the poem. Very sane, very clearly written by somebody who knew literature but probably as well or better than any of the people who were going to be given the job of criticizing the poem. It made people very nervous. It would have been much easier to write a critical essay on this poem if the notes weren't there. It would have been much easier to write a critical essay on the notes if the poem weren't there. You know, Eliot was an intimidating fellow, and he's intimidating for me too, as a reader, as a poet. Burgess has Anthony Burgess, a guy I enjoy a great deal. I think he's a non-card-carrying Christian who is traveling in, well, he's one of God's spies, I think. But we shouldn't tell anybody or else it'll wreck his hearing. But you should look at his book on Moses, a long narrative poem. And it's quite interesting. And at the end of the book, he says, at the same time I was doing this, I was translating the pornographic poems of some, you know, strange character. He'll do something, it's sort of like, he'll do something that's has an interesting Christian content, and at the same time he'll turn loose some strange thing that would make people not think he was associated with Christianity at all. But he does move these things forward at the same time. Read Wanting Seed if you want to see more. But this quotation from him is that what remains after you read a poem like this, what remains? And he says, what remains is the power of the language, the purification of the dialect of the tribe. That the whole new language of poetry, right off the street, got into this poem for the first time. It was at the same time, it was avant-garde, using the dialect of the common speech. It was done in many times with a classical hand that had made for the first time English dialect, American dialect, acceptable in great poetry. Now, some of this had been done before. It was a movement through the realistic period, the naturalistic period, and everything. But never had there been a poem like this, this big, that had done that, and done it without rejecting the validity of the classical styles. and diction. What remains is the power of the language, the purification of the dialect of the tribe, and the big magic of words that we do not always understand. I love that. The big magic of words that we do not always understand. Now, don't feel like you're a dummy if every line of this poem isn't crystal clear. That's a mistake that I used to make as a student listen to the phrase that moves you to remember, makes you want to remember, that a phrase that connects with something of your own past. If only one phrase of this whole poem hits you that way, I think you should get down on your knees and thank God you're a genius and not feel like you're some sort of dummy and then never read poetry again. This is, I think, the hardest poem that I've ever encountered. It makes Stevens, comedian in the letters C, look like child's play. So this is a difficult poem. Don't feel bad if it seems that way to you. I read from Canterbury Tales, talking about the response to spring. This section, the first section, is called The Burial of the Dead. In the burial of the dead, we see the living choose death. They choose death. Spring is a condemnation. If I'm feeling dead inside, to see horses running through a field, in a sense, condemns me. Does that connect to you guys in your own past? Let's see. When you're feeling all screwed up inside, dead, you don't respond to things. Nothing smells that good, nothing looks that good, nothing sounds that good, nothing tastes that good, nothing feels that good. And you walk out into a spring day where everything is exploding with life. There's a kind of a condemnation there. You feel cheap. You can feel cheap. And if that is, from our normal experience, if that's sort of squared, you get to the point where April is a cruel month. You see how that works? April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. New voice. Summer surprised us coming over Starnbergersee with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight, into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar kein Russen, stamm aus Lithuanien. I am no Russian. I come from Lithuania. I am pure German. Now, in what kind of a world can someone say that? And it makes sense. After what? Only after what? World War I, in which this lady is a high-class refugee, okay? The whole map of Europe has been chopped up into new pieces. I'm no Russian. I come from Lithuania. I'm German. What? Now, that starts a theme of the refugee. It's going to continue through this poem, because I think everyone in this poem is, in a sense, a refugee. This is after Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, and in a sense, the far country is gone. And we're here on this earth, and we're foreigners, and we're refugees on this planet. The lady says, Bin gar kein Russen, stamm aus Litwein, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went, in the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in winter. This voice, this is Marie, this is the hyacinth girl. This is a nervous, inhibited, wealthy lady, modern lady. Now you hear Old Testament prophets speak. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish, son of man? You cannot guess. You cannot say or guess. For you know only a heap of broken images. You know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock. Promise is coming through here. And I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. That all in the burial of the dead, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. I will show you mankind. Dust trickling, that's all we are, this image. There was promise in those lines, and then crack, you get that. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. It reminds me of Lorca's statement, he says, about World War II, when everything was fine one day and the German bombers came in the next day, and his Guernica is, and you know, some of you know Picasso's painting, it's so powerful in black and white. And Lorca wrote a poem about it, and the bombs came down and blew the killed children and everything. And he says, and dawn came and threw a fistful of ants in your face. You know, fistful of ants in your face. The promise of dawn, and whap. Just nothing more. You imagine that. That was what happened. And this is what the Old Testament prophet voice is saying. Then something from Tristan and Isolde. Fresh blows the wind homeward, my Irish child. Where are you tearing? It's from an opera. I don't know much of that. I don't make much of that. I don't worry about not making much of that. Then Marie says again, you gave me hyacinth first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. A man, proof rock, but a little more Hamlet and a little less a clown, says, yet when we came back late from the hyacinth gardens, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence. The first noticeable lack, the heart of light, the silence. Waste and empty the sea, is the next line. Now we meet another lady. We're shown another lady by this sort of Bostonian fellow, his proof Rockian character. Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold, nevertheless is known to be the wisest woman in Europe. Now, this is the wisest, the height of wisdom is a fortune teller. Now, trying to look into the future is a forbidden thing, but this lady's gonna do it. And how well does she do it? How wise are her images? What connections does she make? What does she, from tarot cards, which used to be interesting myths, what has become of those, the whole thing of tarot cards? And these characters that she's talking about are figures on tarot cards. She's known to be the wisest woman in Europe with a wicked pack of cards. Here, said she, is your card the drowned Phoenician sailor? Those are pearls that were his eyes. Look, here's Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here's the man with three staves, and here the wheel, and here's the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I'm forbidden to see. I did not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking around in a ring. Thank you. Sounds sort of like, you know, going to a bad psychiatrist. You know, there are some really good ones, but it's sort of like going to a bad psychiatrist. Schizophrenic, you know, schizophrenic, paranoid, hypochondriac, blah, 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 blah. Thank you. Now pay me, and thank you a lot for telling me the truth of my life. You see the point? Or a connection there? Reminds me of a thing in the movie that you did see, I believe, the ruling class. The lady asks the psychiatrist, tell me the truth. And he says, oh, don't ask me for the truth. I only have explanations. And in a sense, you have something like this going on here. Now, the irony is that the lady doesn't say anything meaningful or make any of the connections that between this, you know, doesn't explain anything, doesn't even dig into trying to show any significance here. Just puts the cards out, bang, 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 a bunch of what? Broken images, see, from the previous page. For you know only a heap of broken images. The Phoenician sailor, Belladonna, woman with man of three staves, the wheel, no hangman, a blank card, something, just images. That's all we have. There's no connection. The interesting thing about this passage is that it becomes meaningful at the end of the passage. By the time the poem is over, this has become meaningful. The hyacinth girl is the lady of the rocks, Belladonna, the lady of situations. The Phoenician sailor comes in part four. The fact that there is no hanged man, there is no Christ, there is no one to die in winter and be born again in spring and bring back life to the wasteland. A very interesting fear death by water. I think Karen, wasn't it you that did the fear death by water, the sense of baptism? That death is wrapped up in baptism that is so close in all the passages in the Bible. I see crowds of people walking around in the ring, Dante's Inferno, Dante's picture of hell, men walking around in the ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days when carrying such valuable, important things. You see. Now, Eliot, as a poet, is being ironic about this whole thing. The wisest woman in Europe makes no sense. Nonsense. Unreal city. Isn't it nice to know that a poet the size of Eliot was the first guy to say unreal? You know? Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. These are Dante's lines again from the Inferno. Yeah, London is hell. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours, and a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. It was when Christ died on the cross. Also, it's when you go to work. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, "Son of no hope, Stetson, son of no hope, you who were with me in the ships of my lay, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year, or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to man, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite reader, my likeness, my brother." We don't want a resurrection of life. If there is a resurrection, it's only an object of guilt, corpse buried. The only resurrection we can conceive of is digging up guilt. We don't want that. The dog, a symbol for animality, which is frightening to this world, people in this world. It's too lively. It's too dangerous. It'll dig up guilt. It'll dig up. If we go with it, we have to be afraid of the animal. I don't know if you should make anything about capitalization of D and it's God backwards. I don't know. I think capitalizing the D would do something like that. Because there's no reason to capitalize the D outside of that. Chapter two, the part two, a game of chess. I mentioned before that there's an irony, where the irony of the first chapter was the burial of the dead. We choose death. The corpse in itself is our, in a sense, is ourself. We've killed ourselves, and we don't want to be raised to life. We're so afraid. Fear in a handful of dust. The self, we want to stay buried, and we walk as personages, which we'll talk about next week in Meaning of Persons. We walk through life. I think a good thing to mention at this time maybe is the quote that begins this whole poem, which is comes from Petronius. And it says, "Yes, and I myself saw with my own eyes the Sibyl of Cumae hanging in a cage. And when the children cried at her, 'Sibyl, what do you want?' she used to reply, 'I want to die. I want to die.'" And you do too, is what Eliot, I think, is saying. You, hypocrite reader, my likeness, my brother, drawing us in here. Now, the theologian of Jacques Ellul talks a lot in the presence of the kingdom about our idolatry of death. People have talked about that for a long time. It's interesting to know that in this poem, Eliot had not read Freud before he read this, and yet there's some really interesting things that come through the poem. Okay, the irony was that we want to die in the first thing. We choose it. The irony here in the game of chess is war. There's a war where no one touches. You look at a scene that's supposed to remind us of Cleopatra's barge in Antony and Cleopatra in Shakespeare. Beautiful scene, rich, and there was love there at the time. And that passage from Shakespeare, the chair she sat in, you know. Well, in this, what's happened? There's a magnificent aridity about this passage. Well, let's just read it. "The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden Cupidon peeped out." Another hid his eyes behind his wing. "Doubled the flames of the seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it. From satin cases poured in rich profusion in vials of ivory and colored glass, unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned the sense in odors. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the lacquerea, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling, huge seawood fed with copper, burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone in which sad light a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantle was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene, the change of Philomel by the barbarous king, so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, jug jug to dirty ears. And other withered stumps of time were told upon the walls, staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room enclosed. Footsteps shuffled on the stair, under the firelight, under the brush, her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you're thinking. Think. I think we're in Rat's Alley where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing. Again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your hand? This is a conversation between the man and the wife. Again, you get the promise. It looks so rich. The antique past. Everything is synthetic. It's all artifacts. Synthetic perfume and so forth. It's all artifacts. It's beautiful, it's from the past, it shows a grace, there was a grace about it, but withered stumps of time. the promise of the footsteps of the husband going up the stair and then walking into the room, footsteps shuffled on the stair, under the firelight, under the brush, her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, the promise, and I will show you fear in a handful of dust, spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still, and then this neurotic conversation happens. This is the marriage, maybe from Blake. Is there nothing in your head but, oh, 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 that Shakespearean rag, it's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so, and what shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? He answers, the hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door, and waiting for death. What will we do? The organized life, the high class rejects life. The door opens and we walk into a bar, low class. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words, I said to her myself. Now, this picture is, the lady's talking. About a friend of hers, but what kind of a friend, we'll see. Albert has been off to war and is coming back. Albert has given some money for her to get some new teeth, and she doesn't. She looks real old and haggard and everything. And she says, I can't help it, because it's those pills I took to kill my child. To kill my child. It's an abortion is happening here. It's these pills I took. There's a rejection of life. The physicality is there, but the denial of life is there at the same time. There's no physicality in the other one, and that is a mind produced. The mind forged manacles. You know, maybe in both cases, but in the first case, in the high class, it's neurosis that got it. In the second case, it's a denial of the physicality is run with, but then the denial of the fruit. When Lil says, and hurry up please, it's time, is the guy trying to close the bar. Okay? You know, there's a barman. This is taking place in a bar, and it's the barman comes in and talks. And just one more comment, then I'll read that passage, is that there really was someone who died by water in this poem, and that was Ophelia, who says at the last lines of this section, good night, ladies, good night, sweet ladies, good night, as she goes and drowns herself in the play Hamlet. She drowns herself in the stream. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, hurry up, please, it's time. Now, Albert's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you've done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did. I was there. You have them all out, Lil. Get a nice set, he said. I swear, I can't bear to look at you. And no more I can't, I said. And think of poor Albert. He's been in the army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it to him, there's others I will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something like that, I said. Then I'll know who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight look. Hurry up, please, it's time. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't, but if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique. Boy, talk about a cut. And her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already and nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, then there it is, I said. What'd you get married for if you didn't want children? Hurry up, please, it's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home and they had a hot gammon and they asked me to dinner to get the beauty of it hot. Hurry up, please, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time. Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night, Tata. Good night, good night. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. The ironic contrast of Ophelia and these sweet ladies. The fire sermon. Fire sermon is passion, is fire. And there's a fire of passion and there's a fire of purification. And this is a sermon. And I guess we'd ask, is there either a fire of passion here Is there a fire purification here? It's a fun thing, knowing that, well, the river's tent is broken. I don't know if Eliot meant this consciously or subconsciously, but he was very richly steeped in the images of the New Testament and the Old Testament. His mother was very religious. He knew the Bible very well, and that the river is the basic image of Christ, and the tent, you know, God lives in the tent of our praise. God lives in the tent of our praise. Now, where does that, is that in the Psalms? Or is it in Isaiah? Yeah, but there is that sense of it that, and I, boy, that image, the first time I hit that image, it just really, lives in the tent of our praise. Christ lives in the tent of our praise, and our praise is broken. There's no praise. And there is no praise here in this whole poem. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchief, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. This is ironic that it is indeed. The Thames is no longer the beautiful Thames of Spencer's time. It's this sort of, it's become a kind of a sewer, you know, for these things. The nymphs, who were symbolic figures back in Spencer's time, when he says the nymphs here, he's talking about the probably secretaries who have as short-term friends the sons of the big shots in town, the city directors. Where we used to have the nymphs in Spencer's time, we have a different kind of nymph now. Nymphomaniac. Now, I don't know. We have a new kind of nymph. The nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, having left no addresses. By the waters of Laman, I sat down and wept. By the waters of Babylon, I sat down and wept. I'm a stranger, a captive in this land, this wasteland. It's interesting that Laman is another name for the lake that Eliot was at the time that he was finishing up this poem, is that when something this hot and this harsh and this intense goes through a person, you can crack up. And that's what he did in this poem. He was at his, he had a nervous breakdown, and he was at by the waters of Laman. It's a Swiss lake sanitarium. By the waters of Laman, I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of the bones, the chuckle spread from ear to ear. The eternal footman hold my coat and snicker from proof rock. The death is waiting. From Marvel's poem, Coy Mistress, time's winged, and at my back I hear time's winged chariot. And so I can't linger and dawdle in my love of you, my coy mistress. We must seize the day. We must love now. And here in this poem, but at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank, while I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening round behind the gas house, musing upon the king my brother's wreck and on the king my father's death before him. It's from Tempest, but do you know of anyone who was a king and is my brother, and whose father is a king too? Do I have a king for a father and a king for a brother?
Christ.
Yeah. And God died and then Christ went to. And we live in that world where neither faith nor joy nor certitude nor whatever from... Darn it, I wish I had this in my mind. I keep looking to you. Not, no?
No, I don't have it memorized.
Yeah, Dover Beach. There's no nor help from pain. So love, let us be true to one another. For the world holds nothing true, but no faith. The sea of faith is retreated. There's no faith anymore. And then you're left with putting your hopes in love. And then we've seen what love, and we're going to see in this fire sermon, how much hope there is in love. When the vertical conversation has been cut off. Does that make sense? The vertical conversation with God is cut off. Stringfellow Barr, I don't know, said that, Carol quotes this, that whenever a culture ceases the vertical conversation, I mean ceases being under God in any given culture, Greek, Roman, whatever, the medieval age, the Renaissance, there's a brief flash of brilliant intensity and freedom as bursts, new discoveries and everything, and then it starts to go fizzle out. It's in the sense it's cutting yourself off from your source. And this, yeah.
Go through that again.
Okay, whenever the vertical conversation, when one lives under something, we live under God, we live under the law even, you know. And a culture can be like that, and then it can be thriving. And then there comes a time in the history of cultures, Rome, Greece, Babylon, you know, whatever, that is cut off.
Before God is cut off?
We cut off the vertical conversation. We're so successful that we start to think that we're God. We quit the vertical conversation. And then as we know, you know in your own life, when you first said to hell with church, I don't know if you've done that yet. I hope you don't ever do it, but at your age, I'd done it. At 14, you know, to hell with this stuff. And there's a burst of creativity and intelligence and everything, and 5.5 years later, I'm in the nut house. You know, but boy, you should have seen my trajectory. You know, and then it just crashed. Cultures do that too. It's one of the themes in here. The king, my father's death before him, and then the king, his father dies. God dies, then Christ dies. Some other things here, there are tons of things to unpack. That's what's so great about great poetry, is that it's you can unpack almost indefinitely. Well, let's just leave it. The bones and the white bodies naked on the low... one other thing I was going to say. I don't know if this works with you. When I was 8 years old, I was in Austria along the Inn River, and I went down there to go play or something like that, and I saw the trail. I saw a shoe, and then I saw another shoe, and then I saw some nylons, and a nylon and another, and some pants, and a skirt, and something. I mean, this little eight-year-old mind just going along, and this whole business, you know, and the stuff was all left behind. I don't know what happened to the person. But to see this trail, hopefully it was skinny dipping. It didn't look like it, because I sat there, and after about the second nylon, I says, wait a minute, you know, and I was just 8 years old, but you're confronting something that, you know, it makes you feel sort of icky, but it's sort of interesting too, and you go on, and I thought somebody got killed or something like that, and I was worried. I was scared. It was so strange. See that.
Never fought anybody?
No, never did. Never did. But with the clothes there, what happened? Was in the Inn River after that. But that scene entered nightmares. White bodies on the low damp ground, and bones cast in the little low dry garret, rattled by the rat's foot only, year to year. But at my back, again, the refrain, but at my back from time to time I hear the sound of horns and motors which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in soda water. Fear death by water. Washing feet, I don't think in any literature that I've ever encountered, is there any other mention of wash your feet than in the Bible? You get a secularization and a perversion of a meaningful thing, an activity. That's what the emptiness of what something that used to mean, now it's empty. Love used to mean something, and now it's empty. Faith used to mean something, and now we have none. Back in Prufrock, you had the last sacrament of toast and tea. Again, the secular sacrament. There's nothing there. There's no food. It's not body and blood. Toast and tea. And here you've got feet washed with soda water. Line is... And oh, those children's voices singing in the chapel, singing in the choir. The contrast from oh, those children's, beautiful children's voices singing in the choir, think of the Vienna Boys Choir, and that contrasted with, oh, the moon shone bright and Mrs. Porter and on her daughter, they washed their feet in soda water. I think an Australian popular song at the time. Twit, 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 jug, 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 so rudely forced to rue. Unreal city.
Yeah. Could we go back just a bit? I didn't quite follow the bones cast and a little loader idea. Yeah, by the rat sort of year to year.
Well, I connect the white bones naked on the load, or white bodies naked on the low damp ground. It's a contrast between that line, which seems to have some possibility. Again, it's the Eliot continually gets you, leads you toward, in one direction, and then slaps you with something. You know, oh, the river's so great, and then, ugh, you know, and then the testimony of summer nights, the nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors. I hear at my back the rattle of the bones. Then you have the white bodies naked on the low damp ground, and bones cast in a little low dry garret, rattled by the rat's foot. Only year to year. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. You know, stuffed with straw. Rat's feet over broken glass is in that hollow men thing line. A line from Gerontian. We stiffen in a rented house. We stiffen. While I'm waiting, what is happening? What's my life like? I stiffen in a rented house. Me. This is my rented house. It's not even my. I don't even belong to my body. It doesn't even belong to me. And my spirit stiffens. I think this is what's happening some here. Beyond that, I can't chase it, at least now. Okay. Is that unreal city under the brown fog of a winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents in sight, asked me in slangy French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel. The Tiresias is speaking. But Tiresias is both man and woman, and at this point is taking the shape of a woman. And this Smyrna merchant, this Mr. Eugenides, is picking her up to take her to a resort hotel at the Metropole, which was a common place to take people for one night, two nights, a weekend, whatever. Unreal city. This is what's love is, what has happened to passion, what has happened to love is the theme. Eliot in this talks about this passage as being the one in which the whole substance of the poem is revealed. In this passage right here. Unreal city, under the brown fog of a winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents in sight, asked me in slangy French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting. That image is, to me, I don't know, is that a striking to you? While the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting. Nowhere to go, the soul gone, no direction, you see? You know, a taxi out in front of an old railroad station?
think of the heart throbbing, and here it's not a heart, it's a machine.
It's a machine. You get that image again later, don't you? She smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts the record on the gramophone. But that sense of the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting, with nowhere to go.